It is the 12th, the 1st of December, and this is the Privacy in the Digital Age class. We're going to continue our discussion, ultimately, of workplace privacy issues, looking generally at communications, and then more specifically at some of the different issues with regard to governmental employers. But it would not be a day without news in digital privacy. Anyone hear about this one? Carrier IQ? Our favorite privacy advocate, Senator Al Franken, today is looking at a software package that is apparently installed on, quote, millions of smartphones and logs and may transmit sensitive information. And no one's quite sure of what it is and why it's there, but it's apparently on phones from many manufacturers, including potentially, that wasn't helpful, Senator Franken. Hold on. Thanks. So we can get to this press release. There we go. All right. Thank you. So here's the full story. Earlier this week, a researcher confirmed that software developed by Carrier IQ was logging, that means saving to the device, and potentially transmitting the sensitive information of consumers, including when they turn their phones on, when they turn their phones off, the phone numbers they dial, the contents of text messages they receive, the URLs of websites they visit, their search queries, even when encrypted, and the physical location of the phone, even when the customer has expressly denied permission for an app that is currently running in his or her own location. So we have Senator Franken sending this letter, and if you want to see more about this research, so ZDNet says, so this is this Carrier IQ is this software. We are deployed by leading operators, it reports, to monitor and analyze the performance of their services and mobile devices to ensure the system, network, and handsets works to optimal efficiency. Carrier IQ acts as an agent for the operators. Each implementation is different. The diagnostic information actually gathered is determined by our customers, the operators. Carrier IQ does not gather any data from devices. So we have this software that is running on many phones and many devices that supposedly records this, also supposedly sends it to the carriers. You don't know, this is not an app that you install. This is a piece of system software that is running on your device and is recording to someone on Nokia, Android, and RIM devices at least. So here's what Wired has to say about it. And someone says, secret software on millions of phones logging everything. So here's, let's see how long is this video. 17 minutes, we're not going to watch it. But you can take a look. And he's this, they call him a hacker. Some people call him a hacker, others call him a researcher. But in fact, your phone, your mobile device, may be recording information that you didn't give it permission to and sending it who knows where. In addition, all the people you know are collecting information. So that's one piece of news. Another piece of news, I just thought the The headline from the New Yorker today was relevant: "Is privacy evil?" And this is talking about the hacking of phones and other things by News of the World in London. And this person who was a witness was so dismissive of anyone's right to privacy that it raised this issue of, is privacy evil? We had an argument in the Supreme Court yesterday, the U.S. Supreme Court, over whether damages for mental and emotional distress can be recovered for violations of the Privacy Act. And this is very specifically relevant to what we're going to talk about tonight. The Privacy Act in question is the Privacy Act of 1974, which, as we'll see, deals with governmental transparency. The obligation, it's a post-Watergate statute, and it has to do with the obligation of the government, generally speaking, to disclose when the government may or may not disclose records about people. And this has to do with workplace information that was fed from by the Federal Aviation Administration to the Social Security Agency about private pilots, and the governmental agencies collected. Actually, I'm going to take this back. I misread this story. I thought it was a workplace one. It's not. So let's put this aside as relevant to tonight. It's still an interesting point. This is not about governmental workplace data. This is generally speaking about governmental privacy and what information governmental agencies may share about citizens, even with other governmental agencies. And here you have the FAA sharing information about, among other things, this pilot's HIV status with the Social Security Administration. He had hidden that. And so he sued for willful violation of the Privacy Act by sharing his medical record without his consent. And the question here is, does he have a private right of action for non-economic damages? And there's a split in the circuit. So this is a privacy-related case having to do with the government, but not about a government workplace today. Oh, and one other relevant note. We discussed just the other night the issue of whether workplaces were entitled to take action against employees for the contents of their Facebook or other public postings, or whether that was covered by the National Labor Relations Act, right of collective organizing, and talked about a case. Today, I attended and spoke at a seminar on social media and legal issues, and one of the other speakers raised that exact case and that exact point. So you learned what a lot of other people went to the Harvard Club to learn today. Harvard Club. I hope nobody here is offended by it. It's very Harvard-y. It's not quite crimson, but, you know. Okay, let's talk substance here. As we began discussing on the other Thursday, which I think other people call Tuesday, when we look at issues of workplace privacy, not general, but specifically in the workplace, we have these balancing of whether and how much one can have a reasonable expectation of privacy at all in one's workplace versus the employer's requirements. And there are issues of what kind of search or what kind of information is being looked at, why, on the type of employer, bodily searches, drug tests, office furniture, calls, emails, and internet use, and we looked at some of the more physical behavior monitoring issues on Tuesday, and talking about why employers might want to legitimately monitor whether it was the employee's behavior or, as we're going to look at tonight, their communications. So we talked about behavior. So why might an employer legitimately wish to monitor employees' electronic communications? Phone calls, emails, text messages, and the like. What legitimate business purposes might there be for such monitoring? What do you think? None? You've all decided there is no legitimate purpose. Every bit of this monitoring is, in fact, illegitimate. How will monitoring phone calls or emails ensure that they are doing what they're supposed to be doing? Okay. So if that's true, and I would agree with you, it may well be true, what kind of monitoring is needed? To what extent must a call be monitored or an email message be monitored to gather that information? Let me ask the question a different way. If you pick up a telephone and someone is speaking on the other extension, how much time does it take you to get a decent sense of what the call is about? Right. You may have the experience that I have with in connection with my wife, where I could just hear almost how she says hello or just a few parts of her conversation, and I will know probably with whom she's speaking and about what she is speaking. All right? So if, assuming that our shared experience is commonplace, then to what extent need an employer monitor a telephone call to make a determination? And that's the way, generally speaking, the legal doctrine has developed with regard to telephone calls. One does not have an expectation, an unlimited expectation of privacy in business telephone calls. Business phone system belongs to the employer, provided for work purposes. Generally speaking, private employers are entitled to monitor calls in order to determine the extent to which business is being done. But what does that imply is not permitted? Define eavesdropping. Isn't listening in on...
Once you've identified that the call is not something that you need to...
Yep.
You should cut the call the listening at that point.
Right. That the flip side is, because you only need a certain amount, once you've determined one way or the other... the employer's right to monitor those calls ends. Then it goes beyond what is reasonable for the employer, and it may be seen to violate the employee's reasonable expectation of privacy. Does that mean that there are no consequences for the employee? No, of course not. To the extent that there is a strict, firm policy against any personal calls, and the employer determines that there is a personal call going on, that may be a violation of the workplace. If the employer should listen in too much, it may still be a violation of the workplace policy, but the employee may have a counterclaim for a breach of privacy. You had a thought?
Yeah, how does it work when you call, let's say your car insurance company, when the agent picks up, they say, thank you for calling Allstate, before we begin this conversation, I'd like to inform you that these calls may be monitored for quality and training purposes.
Yep.
So do they record the entire conversation?
They might. So let's start with whose privacy are we concerned with? In the context of workplace privacy, who's in the workplace at that point?
The agent.
The agent, absolutely. Now, one clear exception to the general right to privacy is consent. Right? Not only is the agent informing the customer, this call may be monitored for quality assurance purposes. And by the way, as customers, that's not always a bad thing. Because if there's ever a dispute over the contents of the telephone call, one can say, do you have a recording of it, and use that as proof. Of course, one always should take notes of every call you make, personal or professional, with whom you spoke, what number you dialed, what you were told. It is astonishing how effective that can be as a customer service, as a tool to get what you need from customer service, to say, but on this date I spoke to this person and this is what he or she said, could you check my records? Oh, well. So setting that aside, but from the worker's perspective, not only has he or she apparently consented to that recording by continuing to work there, but what purpose does that statement serve for the employer in the workplace context? What can the employee now not say? No, that perhaps wouldn't be smart. But consider, let's assume said employee at some point wants to make a claim of eavesdropping against an employer. Right? Not only might the employer say, well, we have on record a policy that this employee signed, but let's play for the jury this employee in his or her own voice saying, this call may be recorded. This call may be monitored. Very hard for the employee to then claim lack of consent, lack of knowledge to that process. So that statement serves both to notify and get the consent of the customer, but also, and I don't think it's necessarily in the employee's mind, it certainly can serve to indicate consent by the employee to workplace monitoring. Some businesses are required for regulatory purposes to record calls. So once again, we get into issues of the type of employer and the type of context here. If the intention is to determine if a call is business purposes or not, the amount of monitoring permitted is minimal. You make the determination and you get out. If, though, the purpose is quality assurance and training purposes, then the amount of recording permitted would be longer. If the purpose is we need to record calls because we are an emergency helpline and we might need to go listen to them again, or there's a national, you know, this is the White House switchboard and we're recording calls because we want to make sure if there's a terrorist threat, we have a voice identification, and so on. I would imagine that whether or not there is disclosure, calls made from the CIA are probably recorded, well, at least by the CIA, probably by other governments, whether or not the CIA realizes it, because there are national security concerns, and so on. Why is the question? Now, what about, now, the other thing is, how many calls may be monitored? What quantity? May every call be monitored, just listened to entirely? At some point, unless there is some reason to absolutely prohibit any non-work-related telephone calls, it would be difficult for an employer to argue it was reasonable to listen in on every one just to make sure their workplace required. workplace relevant. So what would be the equivalent in email? What do you think? Before we go into any of the cases, what do you think the equivalent would be? Okay, so what kind of keywords, generally speaking, what kind of workplace is it?
Cablevision.
Okay, and what kind of keywords might they be?
If you put your supervisor's name in the email.
Okay.
Or any profanity in the email.
Why would it be... Have they given you a reason why... For example, profanity in an email message would be cause for a filter pop-up?
Well, it's against work policy. Against
why?
The policy of the company.
Why would it be against the policy of the company? Do you think? Why would the company care? Anyone else who are not fellow employees? Why hypothetical company that rhymes with Ablevision might flag email messages that have obscenities in them? These aren't, you know, broadcast television. This is email. Why?
You would see that.
Okay, so that's certainly one possibility. That especially if it were outgoing customer service emails or emails with other vendors, etc., it would not be appropriate business language. It would not reflect the corporate identity and therefore might be problematic. Any other things that obscene language
might...
Right, so you're talking about inbound or outbound? Right, inbound would not be employer related, right? Yes, you'd want to know if people are sending nasty notes, right? But what about employees? When else might a, let's call an email with sexually explicit terms generate concern other than what are you saying to our customers? How so?
If you're sending any emails, you know, maybe one sex to another, you know, someone can get a wrong impression.
Or a correct impression.
Right.
Right.
You know, it's not part of workplace policy.
Right. Not F you, but I want to F you. And so on. Now, it's sort of an interesting thought if the cable company happened to have a pay-per-view channel, right, with explicit titles. Just emailing about them could trigger the filters too. There was a piece on Rachel Maddow's show about a week and a half ago that I think it was Pakistan was planning on actually or at least testing the ability to block text messages through the national phone system containing certain words. And some of them were obvious, some of them weren't. One of them was but. Unfortunately, one of the chief administrators of the national communication system was, his last name was But. So he couldn't even text his own name. That was the kind of the amusing story there. But, so to speak. There are business reasons in terms of tone. There are potential reasons in terms of harassment, where there would be a legitimate business purpose. But keep in mind something, right? What happens? Is it that someone is reading, a human being is reading every one of those email messages looking for the bad stuff? What did you say happens? Is it that every email you send is reviewed by a censor before it goes out? A human censor? Right. What is it?
Some type of software.
Right. It's a tool. So that it's not that every email message is read by a human. It's that email is filtered for specific words. What are the kinds of words, not necessarily in the context of his particular employer, what are the kinds of words might be trigger words for legitimate trigger words for a company's filtering system?
Like in my business of financial services, words like guarantee, offer, some things like that that are going to be triggered on an email.
Because, offers may only be made by prospectus. Please contact us. So, depending on your business, what else? Let's say one works for PepsiCo. Right? You can imagine competitor names. Now, there might be good reasons to put Coke in. Let's say you work for Coca-Cola bottling, and there's a term that happens to be part of the super secret formula. You can imagine that putting that word into the filtering system might make sense, looking for leaks. If there's particular topic areas that are sensitive, a deal that's being struck that isn't public, you can imagine that at least on an as-needed basis, the name of the other party might be stuck into the filter to watch for leaks. There would be a lot of appropriate emails, but also, wait a minute, why is that going to the New York Times? So we can see there would be rationale. What less than appropriate reasons might there be to monitor employee emails? Or phone calls, for that matter. Pure curiosity, right? Trying to look for dirt on people because you have nothing better to do, because you can. Not good reasons. Certainly possible. IT people have access to a whole lot of stuff. Secretaries have access to a whole lot of information. Sometimes employers or managers need to remember this. The company I was at about 15 years ago, the CEO's secretary discovered she was going to be fired because the CEO was emailing the president about it. And of course, she had access to all his email. A few months later, the president's secretary found out she was going to be fired by the same reason. She just disappeared for a few days. So you have to think about who has authorized access. But this is a question, generally speaking, of the balancing of privacy. So if you're in your workplace, how much privacy can you expect in your email? Well, why would you expect any? What conditions might suggest that you as a worker have any expectation of privacy in work email? How do you get to your work email? Because you have a password that you may have set. So while you can assume that the IT department has access to that password, and if you don't assume that, you should, you might not assume that the person at the next desk has access to your email if it's password protected. Right? Allowing you to set up a password, or even requiring you to set up a password, sets up at least a basic level of expectation. No, you're disagreeing with me. Why? So why doesn't everyone in the company use the same password if the issue is outsiders?
Because there is some segregation of duties and they don't want people in other departments able to access other information.
Okay, so knowing that you have a password...
Like in our firm, we don't want the trading department, to be accessed by the marketing people because there could conceivably be some conflicts of interest, or you have to have Chinese rules or whatever it is.
Okay, so given that, do the traders have have a reasonable expectation of privacy that people in the marketing department won't be reading their emails?
Do they have a reasonable expectation?
Is it reasonable for them to expect?
Well, sure, because they would expect that, yes, but not in a personal sense, not in the sense that, oh, these were my emails and, you know, they're not going to be able to read them. It's more of their emails that they should not be authorized to read, because the employer has determined that they want to segregate departments.
Okay, but a lot of the reasonable expectation of privacy has to do with employer policies. Someone who is given a key to a desk.
Most employees sign an agreement that says that they have no expectation to.
Okay, that's fine. So, but let's talk about before we get to consent. If you have a desk with a key lock and you are handed a key, do you have a reasonable expectation of privacy in the contents of that desk drawer from casual observation by others? The people in the other offices around you? Maybe, maybe not. It's not your desk. You didn't buy it. It's your workplace. Why? One could see how the argument could be no reasonable expectation of privacy. It's a workplace. It's not yours. Right? You didn't put the lock in. You didn't call in a locksmith. You were handed the key. You have no way of knowing how many other people have that key. So,
casual.
Maybe, you know, the boss's secretary has all the keys. Who knows? Everybody in maintenance has a key. Who knows? So you could argue, yes, I have a reasonable expectation of privacy because I was given a key and a lock. Or I'm in an office instead of a cubicle. I have a door. So I have more an expectation that if I close my door, my conversations aren't as easily overheard. So how the workplace is set up, and the same is true for the computers. Now you say, in your workplace, the traders and the marketing people have different. But what about, let's assume that a trader has a particular client that is his or hers. I don't know if that's true, but let's assume there's a financial services company where people have their own clients. And they are compensated based on the work they do for their clients, right? And they don't share clients. Okay. In that firm, having a password on one's email wouldn't only be for the marketing company part of the, it would be for your fellow traders, right? I'm emailing my client. I don't expect Fred in the next desk to be reading those emails. Do I? Should I?
Absolutely not. I mean, absolutely not the case. The case is that
I'm not saying in your firm.
Not in any firm.
You don't think that one person should have any expectation that fellow trader isn't hacking into his emails?
Hacking?
Well, if there's a password that he didn't share.
Again, it's for those persons outside the firm that may have access, for those persons who are not entitled to have access to that firm.
So, but in my hypothetical, would trader number two be entitled to read trader number one's emails?
That might be the case.
Okay. Right. So does the accounting department have reasonable expectation of privacy in their emails from the non-accountants?
I don't think it has anything to do with
privacy. Again, privacy, how are we defining it? Privacy means someone in this context, not it's mine, but freedom from third-party observation. That kind of privacy. The privacy of a bathroom stall door. The privacy of a closed desk drawer.
But you're balancing a reasonable expectation.
Right. I didn't say an absolute expectation of privacy. Reasonable means there is some, right? But not absolute, not without limitation. If there's no reasonable expectation of privacy, if there's no level of expectation that of non disclosure that's considered reasonable, then anybody can legally read anything. Any employer, and there are workplaces where that's true. I would not have a reasonable expectation of privacy as a CIA employee, or an NSA employee, or a White House employee in the context of my job. But as a Turo employee, I think it's reasonable for me to have an expectation that my emails are not being read by every other faculty member on a regular basis, because I have a password. I don't share it. I know the IT department knows it. I know the dean could probably exercise his authority and get at my emails, but there may be situations where it is and is not legal for him to do so. This is about balance. So where are the balances in the law? One is you look at how things are set up. The more separated, the more likely it is that a court could find a reasonable expectation of privacy. This plays out very interestingly and challengingly, by the way, for in-house attorneys. Because the same notion, or at least a very, very similar notion, of a reasonable expectation of privacy, that phrasing and that type of analysis applies not only in the context of workplace email monitoring or telephone call monitoring, but what? The attorney-client privilege. In-house attorneys, their client is who? Or what?
The company.
The company, right. But they're not speaking to the corporate entity. They're communicating in their role as attorney with executives, with outside counsel, right? How do you mark a telephone call? How do you mark a text message?
What do you mean a telephone call?
I'm not just talking about email, right? It's not, telephone calls can be covered by the attorney-client privilege too, can they not?
Yes, somebody overhears you, but they're usually in their own offices.
That's what I'm getting at. Don't assume that they're in their own offices. Doesn't anyone work in one of these open works environments?
We do, but our attorneys are not.
Then your attorneys are lucky. Because not every company is so forward-thinking. Or maybe they're so progressive that nobody has an office, right? Office without walls. Even the CEO has a desk right in the middle of the floor. No walls. We're completely open. Except the lawyer looks around. And I have had in-house positions where I started in a cubicle. I said, excuse me, I can't have to go to a conference room, assuming they exist, every time I need to have a phone call with someone. It's just not a practical answer. So yes, you know, your attorney has a door, whereas someone else who may be senior to him or her in the org chart doesn't. Because in order for the attorney's protections on behalf of the client to be operative, the phone calls have to be protected from casual overhearing. Speakerphone in the middle of a cubicle, not a strongly arguable privileged communication. So how this plays out in terms of workplace environment, there can be corporate culture factors that actually work against what the attorney needs to preserve the attorney-client privilege. We are unique among workers in that.
Right. Although the attorneys in any company that I've ever worked for has
You ever worked for a .com? by a public company in this context?
Publicly traded company.
Okay.
But then the more closely held something is, the less owners, the more likely that you'll find a greater.
Yeah.
Expectation.
You know,
I
would actually disagree with that, only because,
absolutely.
Right, when one's company gets to the point of being publicly traded. That means there are plenty of very high-paid advisors, right? And compliance issues. And an understanding that some... And by the way, publicly traded means... It's not like the shareholders can just walk in the door at any point. There are, at least publicly traded firms have been told about things like record-keeping and auditing and confidentiality and privilege. Whereas smaller companies... Where it's the corporate culture, and like I said, you haven't worked at the dot-coms. I am sure no one has ever gone through one of your workplaces on a Razor scooter. Just down the hall.
So what are you saying? Because the dot-com is usually publicly traded? Or
no. What I'm saying is the culture matters a lot here. You ever work at an advertising agency? I don't think that the two had anything to do with each other. The openness was a culture issue. Well,
my place, we only have eight people working there. It's just basically an open trading desk, like one back office. You know, one of my traders brings his dog into the office every day. You know, it's one owner. It's one owner of the company. He sits there at the trading desk.
By the way, if you look at Google, Google is a very, very wealthy, publicly traded firm. I suspect it's one of these open workplaces, too. Right, and Apple's probably very much like that.
But I'm arguing for that.
No, but then you have, if you look at ExxonMobil, if you look at, button-down company number X, it's about culture. It's not about whether your stock is traded. And I think there are practical reasons why a publicly traded firm is going to have more systems in place to preserve things, even if the open space, but were the attorneys open or were they in an office?
No place that I've ever worked has an
right.
attorney been open.
Places
I've
worked.
I've seen CEO's offices been open in publicly traded companies. Never private.
I think I don't think that
it's
you
my
can.
Observation.
You, right. What
and
you
I
have there is correlation, but you don't necessarily show causation. In your particular experience,
there
that has
a
been true.
For that, I think
we disagree on this.
Yeah.
But where I'm getting to is more specifically looking at the lawyers. If you are in a company that happens to be funky open culture company, and they tend to be more creative services agencies and technology firms, informality, right? Often you will see, and you can just go through the architecture, particularly about 10 years ago, 10, 15 years ago, this was very trendy. Nobody had an office. Nobody had a desk. Everyone had workspace. We were now laptops. We're mobile. There's wireless everywhere. You come in, you find a comfy place, maybe it's by the foosball table, whatever it is. You create a pod. When you have to have a meeting, you all go to a pod. Very funky, except for the lawyers. Because, and this is not about the law issue from a privacy perspective. This is a practical concern that you may find as an in-house attorney, you've got to buck an entire corporate culture and look like you think yourself to be a privileged individual. Yes, you are, but not that kind of privilege. It's not the silver spoon in one's mouth privilege. It's the, I need to close a door to have a phone call so that my conversation is not, I don't have to be on the stand talking about it. And very few other kinds of employees face that level of requirement. We're just unique in that way. We're special because we have the magical privilege thing. So I want you to remember that there may be additional requirements that operate beyond simply work needs, general corporate culture, Are you an office company? Are you a cubicle company? Are you senior or junior? Sometimes it's the job matters. But the fact that you have doors sets up a greater expectation of privacy than cubicles. Cubicles more than open spaces. Locks on drawers more so than unlocked drawers. Computers with passwords and email with passwords, the more that there is some sort of unique personal identifier that others can't casually do, the more reasonable an expectation of privacy is. It is not absolute, but it does potentially exist. What about a policy? Well, you may have an officially consent to monitoring, but what about the reverse? Is a company's statement of policy that it will not read your emails, it will not listen to your telephone calls, it will not open your desk drawers, is that sufficient to establish a reasonable expectation of privacy? Don't answer that yet. Hang on, we'll talk about a case. As I said, type of work that you do will determine whether a judge or a jury, looking at the totality of the circumstances, would agree, yes, you have it's reasonable for you to expect some level of privacy from casual monitoring, casual reading of your communications, type of company. Now, as I say, the governmental employers, governments are subject to the Fourth Amendment, right? Quickly read our Fourth Amendment. Should have it here, but I don't. Here's our official U.S. Constitution site. I love usconstitution.net. Is this the right one? No. There's a governmental site. That's not the right one. Oh, well. We'll get it from the GPO, Government Printing Office. This is a document. What is that? Oh, here we go. Here's a nice word. The right of the people to be secure of their persons, houses, papers, and effects. Notice it doesn't just say houses. Against unreasonable searches and seizures shall not be violated, and no warrants shall issue but upon probable cause, supported by oath or affirmation, and particularly describing the place to be searched and the persons or things to be seized. Implicit in that, and very clear in all of the jurisprudence, is shall not be violated by whom, by what? By, in the initial instance, the federal government, and over time, the state governments as well. And not just the Congress or the House of Representatives, but anyone working for the government is subject to the obligation not to violate the right of the people to be the security of the people against unreasonable searches and seizures, and the obligation to get a warrant with particularity, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. So it's true of criminal investigations. It's also true of government employers. As much as any employer may have a certain limit on the casual interception of phone calls, the casual reading of emails, the casual rifling of desk drawers, whatever that reasonable expectation is of privacy, governmental employers, have a higher hurdle. Their workplaces, and they are subject to constitutional obligations. Does that mean that every workplace search by a governmental employer requires a search warrant? Stay tuned. Oh, it says not all searches require warrants. So I came across this in preparing, and again, the slides will be up. This is an interesting resource. It is a clearinghouse, so this is a think tank. And I wouldn't rely on this only, But if you want to see the kind of questions that are askable here and the kinds of answers, this is meant as a fact sheet for employees. Look at the questions. Can my employer listen to my phone calls at work? Now, of course, the verb here is wrong. Can they? Sure, they own the phone system. What should it really read? May. This is a permission question. Grammar is important. May my employer. If I wear a headset, are my conversations with coworkers subject to monitoring? Can my employer obtain a record of my phone calls? And may. Is my employer allowed to see what is on my terminal while I am working? How can I tell if I'm being monitored at my terminal? That's a different question. That's a functional one. Is email private? What about voicemail? When I delete messages from my terminal, are they still in the system? My employer's electronic mail system has an option for marking messages as private. You do. If you look at Microsoft Outlook, for example, under options when you're sending an email message, that's where you get the return receipts too. You can mark things as confidential, as private. Doesn't do anything, but you can. Makes you feel better. Are text messages on an employer-provided cell phone private? Can I be fired over what I post on social media sites? Of course you can, but it may be an impermissible dismissal depending on what you say and whether you're subject to the NLRA or whatever. Can employers use video monitoring? What about my employer's promises regarding email and other workplace privacy issues? Are they legally binding? Are there any laws that deal with workplace privacy? Why, yes, there are. And we'll talk about them. So these are the kind of questions, and you're thinking about these issues. So there's some relevant statutes here. In addition, just overall, but when talking about digital privacy, privacy of communications, electronic communications, where should we look? Why look? There's an Electronic Communications Privacy Act that we have discussed in this class before. But what role? We've more looked at ECPA from the point of view of law enforcement, to some extent, and ISPs, Internet Service Providers. What about employers, though? What role are they playing here? What role does Turo Law play with regard to the Turo Law email system? It's the local Internet Service Provider, isn't it? So while ECPA, generally speaking, preserves the privacy, freedom from monitoring and disclosure of communications in transit and in storage, there are some limitations. And looking, for example, at Section 2511, which is the general prohibition on disclosure, but notice what 2A1 says. It shall not be unlawful under this chapter for an operator of a switchboard or an officer, employee, or agent of a provider of wire or electronic communication service whose facilities are used in the transmission of a wire or electronic communication to intercept, disclose, or use that communication in the normal course of his employment while engaged in any activity which is a necessary incident to the rendition of his service or to the protection of the rights or property of the provider of that service. And then it talks about to the public. So what is that saying? That's saying that if you're running your network, the network here would be the Turo network, that it is not unlawful to monitor communications in order to ensure, as part of the rendition of the service. My email didn't get through. Could you check the junk spam mail file folder for me? I do that all the time. They're looking at my emails in order to render the service. Or the protection of the rights or property of the provider. And right there, folks, there is your employer in order to ensure that business is being done. Asking someone from the IT department to read an email or to listen in on a phone call. Of course, in order to protect the rights or property of the provider of that service. Here, the network, the company is the provider. So, beyond any sort of general employer-employee laws, when it comes to electronic monitoring, we have a very explicit statement of permissibility, not only for ISPs, but for private network holders as well. Similarly, when it comes to stored communications, so 2511 is transmission, stored communications in 2702, a provider described in subsection A may divulge the contents of the communication as may be necessarily incident to the rendition of the service or the protection of the rights or property of the provider of that service. Same kind of exception. This is about disclosing stored communications. And there's a lot of other governmental and law enforcement and everything else. But here we have the concept. You run the network. You have a limited right to monitor what's on the network, going through it, and what's stored on it in order to run the system and to protect the business. There's another privacy law. In fact, it's called the Privacy Act of 1974 that turns out to have some relevance here when it comes to governmental employees. Now, as I said in the introduction to today's class, with regard to the HIV positive pilot, the Privacy Act was created after Watergate, and its overall thrust is to encourage transparency, but also minimize governmental secret keeping and monitoring. So there's really two parts to it. On the one hand, governmental agencies are prohibited from collecting more information about citizens than is required to do their jobs, because they have such available information. So they're not supposed to be snooping, wiretapping, eavesdropping, enemies lists, you know, getting FBI profiles in order to find material for smearing, things like that. On the other hand, in order to empower citizens to know what's going on with the government, governmental agencies are required to make records available. Open records, open hearings, transcripts, the government printing office that we just saw for the Constitution section. The fact that reports are published. We don't have a culture of governmental secrecy generally. There are clearly exceptions for national security and law enforcement, all those things. But the general mandate of the Privacy Act is don't keep a lot of information, share as much as you can. But what about the people who work for the government? They are, on the one hand, citizens and workers who have some rights. On the other hand, they are part of the government. And so, because they are part of the government, and because we have this Privacy Act that mandates disclosure, anyone who works for the federal government, has to assume that more of what he or she does at work may be available to the public, may be disclosed by the employer, than an ordinary course. Consider, right, the fairly recent scandal with the Minerals and Mining Agency, where there were all sorts of goings on with each other and with industry lobbyists of various pharmaceutical and reproduction-related activities, and it comes to light. Travel records for everyone from the President of the United States down. How many vacation days did the President... How many Secret Service people did the President travel with? And sometimes it's misreported. $140 million for this, for the Navy to take it. But all of that stuff, right? How many people at the IRS are there? What are their jobs? What are their names? You won't necessarily get the name of every employee of Fredco, but you could probably get the name of every employee of the IRS because of this notion. So, if you consider what the government is required to do with its employees, so each agency shall make available to the public information as follows. Descriptions of its central field of and shall publish state and currently publish in the Federal Register for the Guide to the Public. Descriptions of its central field organization and the established places at which the employees, and in the case of a uniformed service, the members from whom and the methods whereby the public may make information, make submittals or requests to obtain decisions, all these different things about how they do their work, final opinions, administrative staff manuals and instructions to staff, copies of all records which have been released to any person, general index of the records. So there's a lot of requirement of disclosure to the public. This is not just about FOIA, although you have to think about FOIA as well, the Freedom of Information Act, which entitles citizens to make even more detailed requests of the government about what it is doing and what its people are doing. So we have this notion of disclosure that applies to governmental employers, at least federal governmental employers, who are both limited in what they're allowed to monitor, but then obligated to disclose. An odd back and forth. So I thought, any questions so far? I thought it would be useful, although we haven't read these cases, you're more than encouraged to take a look at them in detail, to at least highlight for you some of the key workplace privacy, digital privacy cases that are out there. And the major one that is most frequently cited with regard to email privacy in private employers is Smith versus Pillsbury. U.S. District Court of the Eastern District of Pennsylvania, 1996. Does Smith have a reasonable expectation of privacy in his email? He was fired for transmitting inappropriate and unprofessional comments over his employer's email system. Does he have the right to maintain a wrongful discharge? Because he was an at-will employee. And the short answer is no. He has no reasonable expectation of privacy in this workplace. Therefore, he may not, in his email, therefore, he may not maintain a wrongful dismissal. Now, what makes this case so interesting? Because I think when it comes to as between the employee and the company, right, we're sort of assuming no reasonable expectation of privacy, maybe among fellow employees, and we're talking about that, but as between management, we hear the Cablevision monitors looks for keywords, not unusual. What makes this case so interesting is the fact that it says here, defendant, that's Pillsbury, maintained an electronic mail communication system in order to promote internal corporate communications between its employees. Defendant repeatedly ensured its employees, including the plaintiff, that all email communications would remain confidential and privileged. Defendant further assured its employees, including plaintiff, that email communications could not be intercepted and used by defendant against its employees as grounds for termination or reprimand. But yet, they were. So how do you think the Eastern District of Pennsylvania Court reconciled these two different concepts? On the one hand, well, you know, in the ordinary course, no reasonable expectation of privacy, but the employer said there was. This was not the employer getting consent to monitoring. This is the reverse. An employer promising email was private and would not be read and used against the employee for termination. How do you think, unless you've read the case, in which case, ask how you know, that the court could still find that Smith had no reasonable expectation of privacy and therefore the termination was valid? What was it that's, on what was Smith relying here? Was it a contract? Was it a statute? What did Pillsbury provide to its employees? And that's not what I meant. In terms of how was this done? Repeatedly assured. This is assurance. It assured that they... What is that? What is that? It's a promise. It's a policy, right? And what do we know about corporate policies? They can be changed on a moment's notice, unless there's a legal, right? Effective immediately, all employees may wear casual clothing on Friday. Have fun. Then somebody wears shorts. Big client comes in, memo goes around again. Effective immediately, casual Friday is canceled. Right? There was a reasonable expectation of casual clothing permissibility right until the second memo went out. And does the memo even have to go out? Corporate policy is simply a statement of what is now. Not a promise, not a legally binding promise, right? For the future. So here, when they talk about when there might be a public policy reason not to allow this to happen, and this is not like a drug testing case, urinalysis, where this would not be considered a substantial and highly offensive invasion of privacy. But ultimately here, it's a policy. Then it changed. And that's what's going on here. The policy changed. So, under the Smith case, private employers may read their emails, the emails of their employees, and may fire them based on them. Not for casual, for the hell of it, but for business purposes, even if they promise not to. It's just a very odd situation. Oh, by the way, if you wonder what he wrote, defendant alleges in its motion to dismiss that the emails concerned sales management and contained threats to kill the backstabbing bastards and referred to the planned holiday party as the Jim Jones Kool-Aid affair. Smith was not a particularly happy employee, apparently. It's just a very strange situation. So what the court says here really is, this is not such an unreasonable invasion of Smith's private affairs are concerned, even though Pennsylvania does have this tort of intrusion upon seclusion, it doesn't. So we have here, we do not find a reasonable expectation of privacy in email communications voluntarily made by an employee to a supervisor over the company email, notwithstanding any assurances that such communications would not be intercepted by management. Once plaintiff communicated the alleged unprofessional comments to a second person, his supervisor, over an email system which was apparently utilized by the entire company, any reasonable expectation of privacy was lost. It's an odd case because there was this statement saying that it would not do it. Nevertheless, it did, and there was no liability. Then there's Leventhal versus Napec. Here, what's the difference? Leventhal worked for the State Department of Transportation. Quick exam-related question. What red flag just went up? Smith worked for Pillsbury. Leventhal worked for the State Department of Transportation. What's different here? Right, and because Smith Leventhal's employer was the State Department of Transportation, what issue does that potentially raise that wasn't true in Smith versus Pillsbury? To what is a governmental employer subject that a private employer is not? What do we just look up in the government printing office? What's stuck in the back of your copy of the Constitution? The Fourth Amendment. The heightened scrutiny of a governmental employer. Here, the facts here are, after receiving anonymous allegations that an employee reasonably suspected to be plaintiff appellant Gary Leventhal was neglecting his duties in the accounting bureau of the New York State Department of Transportation, DOT investigators, without Leventhal's consent, printed out a list of the file names found on his office computer. The list of file names contained evidence that certain non-standard software was loaded on Leventhal's computer. This led to additional searches confirming that Leventhal had a personal tax preparation program on his office computer that he was using to run a tax business, and to disciplinary charges against Leventhal for misconduct. And so he sued against the searches and the dismissal. Here, interestingly enough, Leventhal was found to have some reasonable expectation of privacy in the contents of his computer. Why? What's different between Smith and Leventhal? What did Smith do? What was it that Smith did that got him fired? Sent an email to his supervisor or to his manager, right? He used the email system. He used the company email system. That's not what's going on here. In Leventhal, this was not they looked at his emails. These were files on his computer. Locally stored files, not even on the network. So Leventhal had, right? He had a computer in his office. Let's see what we find out about his office. Okay. There was no power on password to gain, so he had an open door, but he had a computer, kind of like it was in a drawer. They turned on the computer and looked at the files. There was no power on password, but once the machine was turned on, some of the menu selections that appeared were password protected. And it appears that they might have actually just used a boot disk to look at the files without going to the menus. Then they looked at the directories. They printed out a list of the file names, including the hidden files on Leventhal's computer. Hidden files are like marking a Outlook private. Hidden files just mean that they're not visible until you turn off hidden files. And if you're wondering how to do that in Windows, it's very easy. You just go to a Explorer window. You click further, folder options, hidden files and folders. Do not show hidden files and folders. Show hidden files or folders. Click done. It's not such a secret thing, but he had hidden things. And he had tax software. So on the one hand, did he have a reasonable expectation of privacy? To some extent, yes. More than an email. These were files on his computer in his office that you had to walk in, turn on, and search for. They weren't lying on the desk. Okay. Not an absolute, but a reasonable. And this was a governmental employer. Which means that it was doing a search. Is it a search that requires a warrant? No. What kind of searches generally do we think of in the context of a warrant? Who gets warrants for searches? What?
Attorney General.
And what is their general job function?
Criminal.
Law enforcement, right? Attorney general may be civil law enforcement too. Police officers. Search warrants generally are in the context of some sort of criminal law enforcement investigation. This was a workplace investigation. Yes, it is a government employer, which means there is heightened scrutiny. You look more carefully. But here, this was about workplace policy, not about crime. So because this was not about crime, the lower standard here, notice, the lower standard here applies. How much of a reasonable expectation of privacy? This is exactly what we were talking about. Why was it that the court found a reasonable expectation of privacy? He occupied a private office with a door. He had exclusive use of the desk, filing cabinet, and computer in his office. He didn't share the use of the computer with other employees of the accounting bureau, nor there was there evidence that visitors or the public had access to his computer. Court goes on. We are aware that public employees' expectations of privacy in their offices, desks, and file cabinets, like similar expectations of employees in the private sector, may be reduced by virtue of actual office practices and procedures or by legitimate regulation. But there wasn't that here. And there was no policy that he couldn't keep personal information on the computer. Only that he wasn't permitted to use it for personal business. Even though Leventhal, it goes on, had some expectation of privacy in the contents of his office computer, the investigatory searches by the DOT did not violate his Fourth Amendment rights. An investigatory search for evidence of suspected work-related employee misfeasance, will be constitutionally reasonable if it is justified at its inception and of appropriate scope. And that was what was found here. And not excessively intrusive, etc. So, Leventhal was not successful in his challenge here. Wrapping my slides. We're here. What other cases? What about child porn? U.S. v. Ziegler, workplace computer. Here, Ziegler was a private employee. Government came in, law enforcement, looking for child porn. There was reasonable expectation. Did not have a warrant. But the employer consented. So, what is the context there? Is there a reasonable expectation of privacy in a workplace computer? In this circumstance, yes, there was, because of the way the computer was set up. Right? So the government came in, contacted his employer, said that they have information that there was some child pornography going into that company somewhere. And the IT department, there was some dispute. What happened? The agent did not get a search warrant because the company consented to the search. So, is that okay? Here, though, so what's the difference here between what Ziegler went through and what either Leventhal or Smith went through? What's the context of the investigation?
Suspected crime.
Which means, unlike even in Leventhal, we're talking about police procedure. We're talking about a very clear circumstance where, unless there is a particular exception to the warrant requirement, a warrant is required. Consent can be an exception to the warrant requirement. But consent does not trump reasonable expectation of privacy. If something is jointly owned and two people have equal access to it, one does not have a reasonable expectation of privacy from the other. If someone is living in someone else's house, you may not have a reasonable, the tenant may not have a reasonable expectation of privacy unless the landlord gives the tenant a lock. But if, you know, you're staying with someone who leaves something out, that person can let the police in. Right? So you've got, is there a reasonable expectation of privacy here? It's a workplace. Okay, it's a private workplace. So we have to look at this, the way this was set up. It says here, his office was not shared by coworkers and was kept locked. There was a master key, but it doesn't mean that that doesn't necessarily defeat a reasonable expectation of privacy in an office given for personal use. So his door was closed. That's the issue here. Yes, it was a company-issued computer, but the office itself was closed. Court writes in a footnote, had the company computer assigned to Ziegler for his business use only been physically located outside a private office, we might have had to consider whether Ziegler had a reasonable expectation of privacy in the device itself in the face of a corporate policy of monitoring the corporate computers. However, we leave that question for another day. So, the privacy here is not on the computer itself. The information was on the computer, but the computer was in an office with a closed door. He had a reasonable expectation of privacy that people weren't just going to barge in or let the police in. The court does not determine here one way or the other what the answer is. There was a rehearing, but notice this conclusion. We have all these different things flying around. He has a reasonable expectation of privacy, but it's in an office, and the computer is owned by the company, right? And the employer has a key. Except it's a law enforcement which means a warrant is required unless there is some exception, including consent. So, here, although Ziegler retained a legitimate
expectation of privacy in his workplace office. Frontline retained the ability to consent to a search of Ziegler's office and his business computer. He had a reasonable expectation of privacy with regard, perhaps, to his fellow employees. It wasn't a public space. Had the company said, no, you may not go into that office, we're not giving consent. You need a warrant or you need Ziegler's consent. Different case. But here, the company consented. It allowed the door to be open. It owned the computer. And because valid third-party consent to search the office and computer located therein was given by his employer, the district court's denying suppression of the evidence of child pornography is affirmed. So this was specifically about, I mean, we understand, right? Exclusionary rule. Had the search been unconstitutional because there needed to have been a warrant, the evidence would have had to have been suppressed. But because ultimately here, although there was a reasonable expectation of privacy in the workplace, closed door, computer was not publicly used, there was some. There was also the right for the employer to consent. It needed to, and it did. Therefore, no warrant required. A party with the right to consent to the search consented to the search. No warrant required. No need to exclude the evidence. You really sort of have to do a decision tree here. Start with governmental employee, private employee. Okay. If it's a private employee, is there a reasonable expectation of privacy? Actually, either way, is there a reasonable expectation of privacy of this employee for the thing that was looked at? Email, files on a computer, desk drawer, whatever. Totality of the circumstances. Assuming there is a reason, if there's no reasonable expectation of privacy, nothing else matters. None of these restrictions on searches are in effect. But let's assume, yes, there's a reasonable expectation of privacy. Next question. Was the search reasonable? Next question is, what's the context? Criminal or civil? Workplace issues or criminal issues? Criminal issues, either way, potential for a need for a warrant. Workplace issues, probably no warrant needed in either circumstance. You look at whether the need, that the rationale for the search was appropriate or not. Was it casual or was it to do workplace protection? You're probably okay if it's workplace protection, even given a reasonable expectation of privacy. If it's criminal, then, either side, was there a warrant? Yes. Was it a legitimate warrant? Good, no problem. But if there's no warrant, either way, you have to ask, was there a valid exception to the warrant requirement? And there are a lot of different exceptions. This is not a crim pro class. This is not an evidence class. This is not a con law class. In an exam question, I would expect you to at least say, to acknowledge that there are times that warrants are not required. Exigent circumstances, you know, plain sight. You don't need a warrant to search if something is in front of your face. There are border searches and consent. Was there consent? Was it from someone who could grant it? Then we don't have to have a warrant. And the search is okay. You have to keep doing this. Think of it as a decision tree, right? Think of it as, I guess decision tree is the best. If yes, then go here. Or maybe it's a choose your own adventure. If you think there was needing a warrant, go to page 62. Nope, sorry, thanks for playing. Go back. Private employees, public employees. Criminal, civil. Reasonable expectation of privacy of the employee or not. Consent or not. If Ziegler had consented, to allowing police to search at any time, we would not be having this discussion. But they didn't ask for that consent. Then we have this case from last year. No, leave me alone. This was a Supreme Court case from last year where the city of Ontario, California issued pagers, text message pagers to its employers, to employees, police officers. At some point, the officers kept going over their monthly limits, and it was costing the city of Ontario, California more money. So they asked the provider for a transcript to see if they were work messages or personal messages. In the case of Officer Kwan, it says many of the messages were not work-related and some were sexually explicit. He was disciplined. And he and a number of other people sued that their Fourth Amendment rights and the Federal Stored Communications Act, which we've looked at today, that's part of the Electronic Communications Privacy Act, that second part, were violated by obtaining and reviewing the transcript of his pager messages. Governmental employee. Does he have a reasonable expectation of privacy? If he does, then, because it's a governmental employee, you have to look at, is there a need for a warrant by the employer as a governmental agency? It's the same test. And was the cell company violating his rights as a service provider because they responded to an illegal request? Service providers are entitled under the Stored Communications Act, one of those exceptions that we looked at tonight, to disclose in response to a legitimate request from law enforcement, from the government. That's why Google keeps giving away information about thousands upon thousands of users. But if the city of Ontario's request was impermissible, was not legitimate, required a warrant it didn't have, then the provider, in giving over the text messages, also violated not the Constitution, but the Stored Communications Act. And the Supreme Court here says, the holding, basically, because the search was reasonable, there was no violation of the Fourth Amendment rights. The majority here writes, well, actually, plurality, you have to look at whether there is a reasonable expectation. It's the same analysis we've been looking at. So where an employee has legitimate privacy expectation, an employer's intrusion on that expectation for non-investigatory work-related purposes, as well as for investigations of work-related misconduct, should be judged by a standard of reasonableness under all the circumstances. So that is what the Supreme Court finds here, and you can read the opinion. But it's the same analysis. These were work-issued phones or pagers, so there might have been some reasonable expectation of privacy, except that would have been true for private business messages. But personal messages were prohibited. The investigation was prompted not by curiosity or a desire just to see what they're texting about, but there were overages, right? They went over the plan. It was costing more money. There was an accounting investigation. And the way to find out whether the use was for legitimate business purposes and therefore maybe the city needed a more comprehensive plan, or uses that were not part of the workplace, they had to look at the contents. And since they had provided the pagers, they were entitled to ask for the information. So what's our decision tree? Private employee or public employee? Here. Government employee or private employee? What was Kwan? He's a police officer. What does that make him? Government employee. Reasonable expectation of privacy? Maybe, maybe not. According to the plurality, it may not have mattered. Let's assume even there was. What kind of investigation was this? Criminal or non-criminal? Was Quan being investigated? What? Non-criminal. Okay. Was the type of search that was done reasonable for a typical employer investigating workplace issues? Yes. Therefore, whether or not there was a reasonable expectation of privacy, and even though it was a governmental agent, governmental employer, no warrant was needed. The request was reasonable. The provider had the right to do it. And then briefly, two cases, and there was a third in California, that go directly to our practice issues. What happens as between workplace email policies and the attorney-client privilege when it is an employee, not the employer, communicating with the lawyer? Scott versus Beth Israel, New York case from about 3 years ago, 4 years ago now? Scott was a doctor. Beth Israel was communicating with his lawyer from work about a potential case against his employer. Left the job, brought the case. The employer said, "We would like to read these emails, see what's in them." Scott objected. The privilege communication between lawyer and me. Beth Israel said, "Wait a minute. The privilege only pertains where you have a reasonable expectation of privacy. You, Scott, were an employee. We told you we monitor, we have the right to monitor our own email system. You knew this. It was a policy. We told you. You signed it or whatever. So you don't have a reasonable expectation of privacy in your work emails, even if you're sending them to your lawyer." The court agreed. Big issue for us as lawyers, because we don't have control over from where our clients are sending us messages. No privilege here. Stengard, a little bit different. Same kind of a situation. Employee, potential lawsuit, communicating with lawyer from work computer. Difference is, Stengard was using her personal Yahoo Mail account and getting in over the web. The communication itself was encrypted. But, there was a temporary file left on the machine when she left the company. And in that temporary file, the cache that all web browser programs store were, among other things, the contents of her email communications with the lawyer. Loving Care, which was the employer, said, "We have this. May we use it?" Not their system, in the sense that the email was sent through a personal private account. But it just so happened they still had the information because of the way computers work. In New Jersey, the case went back and forth. But ultimately, the Supreme Court in New Jersey held that these facts, Loving Care was not permitted to utilize this information because it was not about a waiver of their policy. This was her private account. It was only an accident of technology. Therefore, she did not consent. She had a reasonable expectation of privacy. And because it was a communication with a lawyer, that was enough. Privilege pertains. I put this in, by the way. It will be in the slides. Again, something I found just as a nice listing. The Center for Democracy and Technology has a nice listing on its website of federal privacy laws. Now, a lot of these links are broken, but at least you can see these laws. It's a nice, concise place to start looking in thinking about exam prep. Questions? I will see you next Tuesday, Thursday, right? Email me if you have any questions, but not from work or something.